I'm Selma Qureshi, and this is Neuroscientist Talk Shop, the University of Texas at San Antonio's neuroscience podcast. Today's show is the conclusion of our two-part series on the present and future frameworks in theoretical neuroscience workshop, which was hosted by our own Fidel Santamaria and Horacio Rothstein this past February of 2019. In episode one, we heard about the premise of the workshop at its outset, and today we follow up with a glimpse at the main points of discussion that emerged over its course. The participants self-organized into five work groups that broadly defined the priorities of the workshop, and on this panel, a representative spoke for each. They are Farzan Nadim of NJIT Rutgers for the Organization of Neural Theories work group, Carmen Canavier of LSU for the Coding work group, Krasimir Josic of the University of Houston for the Brain-Body Control Loop work group, Horacio Rothstein of NJIT for the Statistics Dynamics work group, and Fidel Santamaria for the Multiscale Theories work group. One other key point about the workshop is that it became clear very early on that the many talented student participants who competed to attend had a critical voice in shaping discussions. So we decided to include two of them on the panel to offer their perspectives on the workgroups and the future of neural theory. They are Habiba Azab of the University of Minnesota's graduate program and Matthew Singh of Washington University in St. Louis. The panel was bustling with important voices with a lot to say, so I sat this one out and let Fidel lead the discussion. What follows is the first stage in a process that will continue well beyond the workshop, so stay tuned for opinion and commentary papers from each of the workgroups over the course of the next year. Enjoy.
Well, this is the second podcast for the present and future frameworks of theoretical neuroscience, and we are doing it at the end of the meeting. And the story is that we proposed the attendees, we proposed them some ideas of how to divide theoretical neuroscience and how to move forward. They arrived, we didn't agree, I guess, and then the groups were formed in which we believe are themes that there should be a focus on developing in the future for theoretical neuroscience. And those themes are multiscale theories, statistics dynamics, fine red spike time, and we can change those names, but those are the main ideas, and brain-body feedback theories, and organizing theories. So those are five themes, and we have representatives from those themes, and we'll just go around the table and talk a little bit about what we identified, what we see as the future, and the challenges. Okay, so let me first start with Farzan Nadim, and let's take it from there.
Hi, I'm Farzan Nadim from New Jersey Institute of Technology and Rutgers University, Newark. And I represent the group that was in charge of, as Fidel said, organizing theories or theory of theories. And part of our mission was to kind of discuss and come to an agreement on what are the useful categorizations of different theories and different types of modeling in a way that would help neuroscience move forward in at least the next decade or so. And our discussion went on different types of categorization from different types of models to thinking about theory from the perspective of whether it is hypothesis-driven or whether it's simply exploratory, and what distinction is there between theory and models and how that plays into different levels of organization of the, let's say, the nervous system and, you know, understanding the animal or even social interactions among individuals. And we also had a very nice discussion about the role of behavior and how to connect that into the discussion of what neuroscience is and what role theory would play. So that's an overall kind of theme of what our group was responsible for. And I think over the past 3 days where we had our work group working, we accomplished a lot. At least I was very pleased, and I gauged that by the amount of information that came in, the level of discussion in which everybody was very understanding and open-minded in these discussions, so nobody kind of stuck to one thing and started yelling at each other. And I also gauge it by how much I learned, which was a lot. I learned a lot in these discussions, and which pleases me. And I confess that I come in pretending I know everything, but I don't. I just like to provoke people to tell me things that help me understand. And I'm the type of person also that doesn't mind saying that I'm ignorant. So if it comes to it, I say, I just don't understand what you're saying. And that helped clarify a lot for me. So there were points in our discussion where I thought the language of the discussion was going beyond my understanding. It was becoming very abstract and technical. So we brought it down in a way that I could write it in simple words for myself while I was taking notes.
That's what I think that's going to be a challenge for all the groups. I mean, just to, for the audience, the objective is to come up with working papers first that they will be disseminated and published, and people will, and maybe eventually we can reopen them for a larger community. But let me just move to Horacio, that as a rep of the statistic dynamics or dynamic statistics, depending.
Yeah, so I was interacting with two groups, with the deliverable theory group and with the dynamics and statistics group, since Jordan already told. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a representative because I was not appointed to be. But I can tell a bit what was the what we did. We essentially tried to understand the differences between the statistical and dynamic approaches to understanding neural activity at different levels and in general terms. And one thing we understood is that we don't understand each other. And that there is a lot of work to do to try to put this to
but the not understanding is semantic, or is it
not understanding is a mindset, different mindsets, but we are trying to capture, to still need to see, discuss, and try to capture what's the essence of the different mindsets. There are differences in languages, in some cases we want to say the same with different words, and that's when we don't understand each other. In other cases, there's a difference in an approach, in techniques, or in the way we think about the problems. It goes back to the mind.
So I think that's do you think it's a roadblock? I mean, if we want to develop more theory along statistics and dynamics, together or separate, is that a roadblock, or what has to be overcome?
Well, we need, as scientists, we should focus on the problem and develop tools to solve the problems, right? Whether they are in the theoretical tools are dynamic or statistical or whatever, it really doesn't matter. It's not a matter of identity. We are not married to the tools. But what we need to do is we need to try to understand how to combine them, how to integrate them in such a way that we can take advantage of them, right? And that cannot be done unless we discuss them and fight about them and we put them in words that we can convey to the community.
Carmen Canabier, LSU School of Medicine in New Orleans. I'd like to revisit what both Farzan and Horacio have mentioned.
Horacio.
What?
Horacio.
Horacio.
Don't cut that part.
Horacio. Okay, so what they have both said was that we have these implicit biases that we're not necessarily even aware that we have, and this meeting has made us aware of it. And one issue that came up constantly was people have emotional attachments to what the word coding means. And Bill Litton is unfortunately not still here. He was the co-leader of the group that I was in, which was nominally to look at spike time coding versus spike rate coding. But it seems like we came up with, you know, all the groups seem to be dealing with the same issues, because when you're talking about time versus rate, you're talking about coding. So what are you coding? How are you coding it? And the first thing that came up is that there's two different ways to look at coding, and some people don't want to use the word coding for the other way to look at it. And one way is just correlational. What information is in this spike train? What are the statistics in the spike train? What's the mutual information with the stimulus? That sort of thing. But the other way, and that our group thinks has gotten maybe not as much attention and maybe should get more attention is the decoding by the biophysical downstream elements. And it was brought up by the person sitting next to me, in fact, Matthew Singh, that there's multiplexing and that you could have the same spike script train from one neuron going to two different receivers and conveying different information to those two different receivers. And so that concept, I think, only makes sense when you're looking at the causal sense of coding or the point of view of the downstream receiver, because the information in the spike train from the correlational point of view is going to be exactly the same in either case, but the two downstream receivers are going to get a different picture. And then just simple things like, you know, firing rate versus temporal coding, I mean, rate coding versus temporal coding. The simple thing is just how do we define firing rate? And it turns out that we were using the same words, but we had a different picture in our heads of what we meant. So firing rate, as it's often used in these rate-based models, is not an observable, it's inferable, it's not deterministic, it's probabilistic. And a probabilistic firing rate has been used in these firing rate codes. The one I'm most familiar with is the classical, if you have a neuron and you give a V1 neuron, for example, and you give a stimulus, you give repeated trials, you're going to get different different results on every trial. And so one of the other themes that we keep coming back to is there noise in the nervous system and what's causing this variability? And Bill and I are of the opinion that, well, I guess that I don't think I'm going to get into that one. That's a little too hairy and I don't have that much time. But just probabilistic code, this rate code that you have to average over something to get this to infer the probabilistic rate. So the version I'm most familiar with is coding over a population of neurons. So if you give a stimulus, all these neurons respond in their probabilistic way, but they all have the same inhomogeneous firing rate, then you could infer that probability of firing by averaging over your inputs. And I think that's the most common version, but I was talking to Tatiana earlier, and we're not sure if that particular version is instantiated in the nervous system. If someone has an example, we'd like to hear about it. And there's other versions of rate. So I'm trying to think if there's any other main points. Coding by assemblies, I know, is particularly important. So I think there's other definitions of rate coding other than the classical one that I just described. And so in our paper, which we've got a draft where we've all been working on it kind of asynchronously, and our hope is to put out a paper on titled firing rate versus temporal coding, some kind of a false dichotomy. That was it. That's all I have to say on that.
Good. Let me just keep going with the group. So, Kresso, can you tell us a little bit of what you guys discussed?
Yeah, so I'm Kresso Josic from the University of Houston in the math department. So I was part of the group on embodied cognition. I think we had several different titles for the group, but the idea was to really distinguish or look forward towards using more naturalistic types of experiments to analyze the responses of the nervous system. In particular, frequently, for very good reasons, we have been using stimuli that are presented in uncorrelated fashion, so from trial to trial, and in such a way that the animal was not able to choose what to pay attention to, and therefore the space in which these stimuli live was relatively low-dimensional. Now, this is for a good reason, because it allows for a much more consistent and simple statistical analysis, increased statistical power, and so on, and the interpretability of the results. However, it is also divorced from the natural situations in which an animal typically will make decisions. So we were thinking about how to move beyond that in different ways, and these are not completely new ideas, but will have to be developed further. So one of them would be closed-loop decision-making. So these are cases in which an animal is allowed to choose the next stimulus, or where the next stimulus depends on an action that an animal has performed. These are decisions that are done in a social context, so with multiple animals interacting, either cooperatively or competing, and or both, in situations in which an animal has a choice, or a pair of animals has a choice to either cooperate or to compete, and as well as decision makings by social animals. So these are all all of these have been areas that have been studied in different fields, from economics to other parts of biology, ecology in particular, but have maybe not been examined from the viewpoint of neuroscience. And now with the advent of new recording techniques that allow us to record from freely behaving animals, the hope is that we will gain new insights into the neural underpinnings that underlie these behaviors.
Well, so I'm Fidel Santamaria from University of Texas San Antonio, and I was in the multi-scale theories. And the objective of this is something that is happening across the planet. There are initiatives in Europe and in the U.S. and other places that want to build mechanistic, we can discuss what mechanistic is, but models that can start from the activity of a neuron, abstract or biophysical detail models, and then build from there up to networks. And as you build up to the next level, you want to abstract the other scales. So the traditional, what we see as the method of choice at this point, or one of the methods of choice, was mean field theory. And then we are just asking the question, well, is mean field theory going to be enough, given all the data and the heterogeneity that we're getting out of that data, massive amounts of data? And we expect that to be increasing in the next 5-10 years as data acquisition in anatomy and electrophysiology of cells becomes automated. So we ask, well, the mean field has to be able, the theory has to be able to incorporate heterogeneous distributions, right? And we went into some detail on that. But also we asked, maybe mean field is not going to be enough when we have so much heterogeneity, and we will have to develop, take other strategies to model brain behavior. And we also discussed issues of how to cap all these approaches. And we were talking about how to use metabolic consumption as a way to discriminate between models that can be realistic or not, right? I mean, if you have a model that consumes all the ATP in the brain just for a single neuron, then probably not realistic. So that we went into in that direction. And that's that. But okay, so now I go back to the directing the table, I guess. But another objective of this, it was to there was a competition for trainees, grad students, and postdocs to come to this workshop. And Horacio and myself, we thought, let's ask them what is what you're doing now and what is what you're going to contribute. So they had to send us a one page with two paragraphs. And it was challenging. And we selected a bunch of people from across the United States. And I wanted to, there are two at the table, and I wanted to get their impressions of where they come from first, and then what they got from the workshop and your opinion. So please introduce yourself and tell us.
So I'm Habiba Azab. I'm from the University of Minnesota. I work in Ben Hayden's lab. The work that we do is mostly in the prefrontal cortex, and we're trying to understand the neural circuits that are involved in decision-making, mostly value-based decision-making. At least that's been the focus of my work. So I've been very interested in theory as an experimentalist and as a grad student, and I think this has been very useful for me to hear about the questions that we don't know how to solve, and the questions that we are not even quite sure how to tackle, from people who are very well established and very knowledgeable in the field, and all the debates about what do we mean by these terms that we're all using in very different ways were very informative to me to hear people actually discuss these things head on. was very useful.
If I can interrupt for a second, I think rather than listening and hearing, you were participating actively in the discussion.
Yeah.
So I believe that, I mean, not yourself, not you personally, but all the students and trainees. So
we were afraid that they were not going to say anything, actually.
Right. So,
We were wrong.
Yeah.
Unlike the well-established faculty, at least me and I think many of my colleagues, we're not afraid to say we don't know what's going on and we don't understand. So it's we need to speak up at some point to be like, okay, what are you guys talking about?
So how was that experience?
That was very informative, and it was great to see such different perspectives coming together, because sometimes we read about these concepts and we're like, oh, I don't quite know what this concept means. And now you realize that there are two different concepts. It's just the same name. So it was very illuminating to see this, and also to hear people talk about what we don't know how to do, which doesn't come through oftentimes in papers except like in the discussion section. So it's very good to hear like, okay, these are actually open problems. Nobody knows the answer to this. I was personally in the Theory of Theories group, and one of the insights that came out of that that was very gratifying to me was the idea of exploratory theory formation. A lot of times, especially in written papers, the end product emphasizes like we had this hypothesis, we knew exactly what we were going for, and that's what we found. I work in the prefrontal cortex, and it might just be my ignorance as a grad student, but I feel like we don't know much. We don't always know what we're going for when we're going in. So it was very gratifying to hear this formalized as like there is such a thing as exploratory theory formation. This is how you can do it well. These are ways that we can do it better. So I think that was one of the big takeaways that I walked out from this workshop with.
And we also have, Matthew.
I'm Matthew Singh. I am coming from Washington University in St. Louis. I work with Todd Braver in the Department of Psychology and Xinong Qing in Systems Engineering. And we study how to identify dynamics in the neural system, how to model the dynamics of whole brains, and how to relate these dynamics to cognition. So that, of course, involves varying levels of abstraction. It was very interesting to see the different levels which the different PIs here worked in terms of some who were almost purely theoretical in terms of working with mathematical models and then extending those into things that can be simulated more easily or abstracting those directly in terms of behavior, as opposed to those who were really involved in data collection and in the early stages of theory development in terms of getting the theory in terms of modeling the neural activity they observe, but weren't quite sure yet exactly how to translate between skills. I thought it was really interesting to see how different investigators at these levels interacted and different ways of phrasing arguments in terms of do I want to start with a very specific example and that can make, inform us about what are the limitations of an idea versus do I want to start with a general framework that I think we should use to frame all of our thoughts going forward. I was actually glad with the work that my group did. We were the multi-scale modeling group. We had a very different approach than some of the other groups in that ours has a very tangible application in that we were thinking of how do we improve, models themselves rather than theories. And so we thought we took the usual approach with the bottom-up perspective, and we actually identified some new ways that, models across all scales were lacking some information. And it was nice to see the interplay of, the different work that each of the contributors, Alain and Estix, and John Menzel had, as well as Fidel, of course, and their own perspectives in terms of looking at their data and perhaps things that maybe not have, made into wide circulation yet to get a very hands-on feel of what are they actually seeing and can't explain yet in the form of a published piece.
Good. Horacio, do you want to...
No, I'd like to ask Farzan, because we talked about that, but the rest of the PIs present here, how did they saw the participation of the graduate students in the work?
I was actually quite impressed with the graduate student and postdoctoral trainees that were in our group, because I think their contribution was equal, if not more, than most of the PIs who were present. And especially in pointing out the issues that needed clarification, and also coming up with, I was very impressed with this, coming up with examples from the literature of things that we couldn't, you know, the group was searching for, but we couldn't immediately come up with examples. It was the postdocs and grad students who came to the rescue, because I think they have the fresh mind and they keep up with the literature that's as it's coming out and keep everything in their heads, where, you know, most established PIs, we have become very forgetful and we are looking more and more at the big picture and forget about the actual details that matter. So in that sense, I think without the graduate students and postdocs present in our in this workshop, it would have been a much, much poorer experience. And I don't think we would have accomplished at all the level of discussion and the level of understanding that we achieved.
I have a question for Barzan. So y'all were talking about, and I remember the original mandate was, what would a theory deliverable look like? Is that correct? And were you looking at that in an abstract sense, or were you looking at what areas do we need theory development in?
No, so the original question we went after is, if the idea of, and at least from my viewpoint, from the Presidential Brain Initiative, if the idea is that a project that is being put into a proposal needs to have as its outcome a theory or a computational model that will capture what it's set to find, mm-hmm. right? Then what do we actually expect out of this? So what is it that we want people to deliver?
Because there is abstract. A confusion.
Completely in the abstract. So the first day that we discussed these issues, we actually came up with ideas and theories that were completely scale-free. We actually discussed, you know, what would a theory be, how would a model represent it, but we didn't go at, let's say, looking at, you know, the Hushkin-Huxley level, or right. looking at the subcellular level, or the, you know, mean field level, etc. We did not discuss that at all. And then when the issue of scaling came in, which Horacio brought into our discussion, we went back and started discussing levels and dividing things into levels and thinking about, well, where does theory fit in, which we came up effectively with the conclusion is, other than everywhere, one of the places it is really important is crossing the levels, right? Whereas models usually express themselves at one level. Right, it's the theory that will bridge it for us. And I think that whole discussion, in a way, gave us a framework in which we can now come and say, look, when you say come up with a theory, when you say come up with a set of models, you shouldn't have an a priori notion that this is what the model or theory looks like, because it can fall into all these different categories. And each of these would provide insight into what that area of neuroscience is trying to tell us, right? And it would be nice to have different different methodologies of categorizing the theories or categorizing the models, which would allow people to say, yeah, I mean, I'm going after, as Habiba said, an exploratory theory, right? I didn't start with a hypothesis, but I completely acknowledge that this area that I'm working at, I have a question. It requires a theory for everybody, including me, to put our questions into that framework and go forward.
That is interesting, because we all have to do the exploratory part.
Yeah.
But so how do you pay for that?
No, but at least formalizing it and allowing funders to know and allowing the community to know that this is okay. The community acknowledges that we are building theories, and it doesn't always have to be based on a particular set of hypotheses or rules and whatnot, right? But, you know, we have to start somewhere, and it's necessary.
And that goes back to the motivation of this workshop to develop a roadmap for the funding of theoretical neuroscience in the future, and we want to inform funding agencies and people that are interested in funding neuroscience as a guide, right?
So our group was much less abstract in that sense, since we had a particular problem to focus on. And so the theory we wanted was for people to figure out thought experiments, shift jittering spikes, jittering phases of oscillations, and figure out, you know, how is that going to impact the coding? You know, what are the predictions? So you can then determine which coding strategy is involved. And Bill was adamant, you know, that we need, that they're not mutually exclusive, that there's multiplexing and multiplexing within multiplexing, meaning that you can be using different kinds of codes, pattern codes, synchrony codes, sequence codes, rate codes. And it's, I also think it's unreasonable to expect that one rate coding strategy is going to suffice for the entire nervous system of every animal.
So it's fair. Our group kind of shied away from those discussions, partly because we knew that your group is discussing the question of coding versus processing, representation, all of that. And there was another group that was discussing the question of control and behavior and closed loop versus open loop. So we touched on these things, but our focus went mainly in the idea of how do we categorize theories.
I just wanted to add about the why the participation of the trainees was extremely valuable in this discussion, is that at a certain point, experience becomes a burden, especially in looking forward. We had some excellent scientists here, or not some, all of the scientists were excellent, but also representatives from the generation that had made huge strides in understanding the nervous system. I'll just mention a couple. This is not to be exclusive towards the rest, but Carmen, of course, and John Rinzel. And they bring a certain way of thinking about the nervous system that has really allowed us to see from a dynamical systems point of view what cells do. Now, the question is, which parts of that view are going to help us in understanding the population of cells as a totality, how to collectively work to represent information, not just as part of the brain, but as we, in particular, as my group said, as part of a ecosystem which they act upon. Some of these concepts may not translate or may have to be changed when we look at things. When we look at new data, when we look at the new tasks, and when we're trying to understand the different questions.
That's great. I mean, that shows that the discussion was very rich, and people that will listen to this, I hope they get the idea that now the entropy is high again, and there's good energy, and we will work on these papers after this meeting is over. But let me just wrap up, and thank you, everybody, and I just want to say thank you for NSF. This was sponsored by NSF, and also all the other sponsors, the Neuroscience Institute at UTSA that provided all the logistics, Dr. Salma Qureshi, who organized the podcast, and Greg Granados, the New Jersey Institute of Technology, Horacio, and I are the co-organizers of this thing, and the Institute of Brain and Neuroscience Research at NGAIT. And to all participants.
Farzan is the co-director.
Let me just thank the organizers one more time, Fidel Santamaria and Horacio Rothstein, because when you started this workshop and I looked at the participants and I looked at the agenda and I wrote you when you told us what you want, Carmen and I start our discussions with, I thought this is going to be a mess. I thought there's no way you can pull this off. It's just going to be a mess. I said, as I know, you set your expectations very low and like to be surprised and pleased. I am very pleased. I mean, you guys achieved something that I did not think was possible, and kudos to both of you for doing this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. It was awesome.